netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hey, thanks for joining us, everybody, for our first FX podcast of the year 2007. Happy New Year. I'm John Montgomery. Our podcast this week is going to be taking a look at the motion picture Children of Men. It's a film that opened here in the States on December 25th, and as you'll be hearing, it's actually not because it's the holiday feel-good movie, but that actually release date was several months later than the European release. And actually, when Mike and I were in Europe traveling, doing research for the FX PhD training site, Mike was able to actually go check out the film at the Odeon Theater there in London, which is actually an outstanding theater. And I had to stay back in the hotel room and work on the website. But when he came back, I'm actually surprised that he wasn't just depressed out of his mind. Not because the film was bad, actually quite the opposite. We actually really both enjoyed the film tremendously. It was just incredibly bleak and actually quite depressing. The film is set in the year 2027, and what's happened is the human race has lost the ability to reproduce. So there haven't been any children born for years. So the world is void of, you know, children's laughter, running and playing, and just, and people feel this hopelessness of actually not being able to even reproduce. So it's actually quite a compelling story. Now, the film was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, and you might recognize his name. He was actually, first big film probably in the States was To Mama Tambien, and followed that up with Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. He was actually quite a surprising choice for that film at the time, but I think he did an outstanding job of that. And then to Children of Men, his most recent work that came out, and he actually had a screenplay credit on that. Of course, the original story was written by P.D. James. The DLP on it was Emmanuel Lubezki, who Cuarón has actually collaborated quite a bit with in the past on E to Mama Tambien, Great Expectations, and some other films. And their visual approach to this film actually had tremendous implications in the post-process because the pace of the editing and the length of the shots was actually quite long. There were handheld camera moves that were anywhere from, you know, could be 1 minute, 2 minute in duration, I think all the way up to even 9 minutes long in duration. So this had implications in, you know, nailing these 3D camera tracks and nailing all the effects work because the screen duration was so incredibly long. There was actually nowhere to hide, of course. In addition, numerous shots were actually done inside vehicles, so there's a lot of exterior replacements and so forth that had to be done as well. In our podcast this week, we'll be talking with folks from two facilities. In part two, we'll be speaking with Tim Weber, who is the VFX supervisor for Framestore CFC, and their work centered around the CGI baby that was born in the film, really quite stunning effects-wise. But we start out with Mike Seymour's conversation with David Hickory, who is a CG supervisor at Double Negative in London. And that facility worked on upwards of 160 shots in the film, and that number kind of belies the amount of work that was done simply because of the duration of the shots. So why don't we find out what it was like to work on that film and recreate a London that is bleak, decaying, and quite effectively dying.
Thanks, John. And David, you're on the line from us first, and I believe you're really busy at the moment, so thanks for breaking out from your current film to talk to us.
That's fine, Mike. It's fine.
So we were just joking before we went on air that the film was quite emotionally taxing. It wasn't a fluffy kind of pathetically simplistic film in any respect. It was actually quite a thought-provoking film, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and there's nothing fluffy about it at all. And there are some really tense, gritty moments throughout the film, and you're never really expecting them either, which is, I think, is the key to it, is that they hit you very quickly. You go from a very placid scene into something that's very disturbing.
Yeah. Now, the film is set. Is there an actual? I can't remember when I saw it. Was there an explicit time of when this was set? It was like if there was, I've forgotten what the date was.
Yeah, it's set in 2027.
Right.
And 21 years from now.
And we're not giving anything away because it's the premise of the film to say that society is degrading, and this is due to the lack of new children being born.
Yeah, the idea is that at some undefined point in the future, the human race has become infertile. And as a whole, the human race don't have any idea why that's happened. So because of this, no babies are born. And when the film begins in 2027, the youngest person on Earth is 18 years old. And society is disintegrating rapidly as we know it, because essentially the human race has only got 50 or 60 years left before it will become completely extinct.
And
so whilst there have been some technological advances in say the 10 or 15 years from now, basically everything has come to has ground to a halt, and it's very dilapidated.
Yeah, so I'd have to say that from a literary point of view, there were some overtones of kind of a 1984 bleak kind of world, and that interesting mix of technology and reality, because you guys were responsible for providing this. It's not really a post-apocalyptic, it's really a disintegrating London, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So there are sort of number of elements that we added into scenes that sort of suggest technologies that we don't necessarily have so abundantly now, like the huge LED and LCD displays plastered on lots of billboards, sort of subtle updates to the street signage and the cars that are traveling around. But at the same time, there'll be a lot of stuff that we see in everyday life around us, but as if it was 30 or 40 or 50 years old now and had just become neglected and into complete disrepair. So I think what it served to do was to put you in a film that was obviously set in the future, but at the same time was scarily real and scarily believable.
Yeah, that's the thing. It was not. It'd be completely wrong to characterise it as science fiction, because that's to imply some kind of futuristic, you know, quite unbelievable environment. And when I left the cinema, I actually saw it by myself in London, and it was like almost quite freaky walking back through some of the same streets to my hotel in London. It was only like 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night, but still was one of the more uncomfortable walks I had in London. How did you go about degrading London, and also how did you go about putting, for example, all of the, like you were talking before about the LED screens, but some of the more complicated shots had those on the side of buses and trucks in moving shots. Could you walk us through a couple of those steps?
Well, the first thing is to say is that the guys on set did an excellent job, and they were very well prepared. All the buses, for example, would have had all of their advertising removed and green screens left in place. So, for example, one of the shots early on in the film is staged in Fleet Street, and we see a number of buses travel past the camera, and we have the job of tracking those buses and essentially then replacing what we see with a LED sort of shader that we developed. Without going into too much technical detail, the main problems that we have with the shots is actually the tracking. Because all the cameras are completely handheld, there is no motion control in the film at all. We basically have these extremely long shots, often 1,000 frames long, where we're having to track objects that stay in shot for a long time and then disappear from shot and come back into shot again. So the camera will often swing through 180 degrees. It will leave one end of a street, only to come back to it later in the shot. And we're trying to position a set of 3D geometry within that shot that needs to register throughout the entire time it's there.
So what software were you basing the tracking on?
What software did you say?
Yeah.
We used all sorts. We started out using Bougie and 3D Equalizer. Eventually, we trained everyone up on those two pieces of software, as well as PF Track. A lot of people started using Maya Live as well to do tracking.
That's interesting.
But there was also a hell of a lot of very time-consuming, very painful hand tracking that. You know, we have a bunch of really talented match movers here, and they worked very hard getting all these shots looking good.
So were they in the 3D tracking department in things like 3D Equalizer and PF Track, were they doing object tracking, or was it pretty much that they were getting solutions for the camera and then there was a lot of hand tracking of the objects in the scene? Because a lot of those objects you're talking about are fairly rigid body objects that respond to that kind of tracking.
Yeah, they did did. I mean, they respond really well, but so we'd have to get object tracks. So we'd have to essentially track a scene, and then if we have moving objects within that scene, we would need to object track it as well. But at all times, we'd need to get a good camera solve, because it was never, we never had the instance where we would only have, say, one object in the scene that we needed to replace. It would always be a case of there's five or six buildings, all of them need to have billboards put on the side. There's also a couple of buses, which also need to be object tracked so that we can add LEDs onto the side of it as it moves down the street. I think one of the major problems with the tracking as well was that all the shots were so beautifully choreographed that you'd find that a lot of the time there were people passing in front of the camera, people obscuring the view from what we were trying to track. So it obviously just makes the tracker's job that much harder. So they would end up basically, we'd get as good a camera solve as we could in 3D, and then it would go into Maya and we would have to hand correct. So we'd always build geometry to line up to the buildings in the scene, and then we'd have to hand correct frames to get it as good as possible.
Now, you were adding buildings into shots. I'm particularly thinking of the thing that reminded me of Battersea Power Station, which I think the hero's brother, or was it his brother that was held up in, and that he went
Think it's his I think it's a cousin in the film. I think in the book it's described as his brother.
And so for a start, was that a 2D structure or was it a 3D replace?
It was actually a mix. So we have a number of shots where essentially our 3D geometry formed the basis for a map painting. For example, there's a shot where we see Battersea Power Station from the other side of the river. That's primarily a map painting. But we actually had a lot of free rein to create the design for Battersea Power Station. So we ended up doing this in 3D, and there are a lot of shots where we're inside the station itself, looking out across the Thames, and we can see the whole of this new sort of glazed roof structure stretching out in front of us. And that was a large part of the work, was actually designing elements like that to fit into the shot, because although Alfonso may well have had concept work done during pre-production and filming, quite often obviously these designs change and he looks to see new, better ideas or just different ideas. We had a lot of work to do that.
I've got two questions about that. Firstly, were you taking into account lens distortion, and were you undistorting your plates and then giving them the 3D undistorted, or were you distorting the 3D to match into the plates?
No, what we will do is we'll get a plate. We essentially shot our own lens grids on set using a checkerboard. Then we would derive the lens distortion from them, de-lens the plates. We would then track those delensed plates and render our CG, which we can then re-lens as we composite it into the plate.
So what software were you using for that? Oh, was it your own? Or
sorry, what was that?
The
delensing software.
Yeah, was that yours or one of the?
It's a process that's just run through Shake. essentially, we would take a checkerboard pattern and film that checkerboard pattern through each of the camera lenses we're using on set.
Right.
And then once we've got that, we can compare the distortion in the checkerboard pattern that's been filmed through the lens versus a completely undistorted checkerboard pattern, and essentially then just draw a grid that represents the sort of the matrix of the distortion. And it's just a case of then plugging these numbers in.
And that was just happening in Shake, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things that struck me about the film is that a lot of the action takes place, because it is a journey, from inside cars, and sometimes quite small ones. And I imagine that there was quite a bit of visual effects work that required dealing with stuff through windows of cars. And did that pose any special problems for you?
Yeah, one of our major shots, or one of the biggest shots in the film actually, was staged inside a car, and five of the characters in the film are in the vehicle at the same time, and there are a number of sort of very major challenges that we were faced with that. The first off is the shot was nearly 9 minutes long. So they filmed this in six different takes, which were essentially we needed to splice them back together by sort of creating these invisible seams between the takes that they had created. The other thing was that it was actually shot in four different locations. So we needed to make it feel like it was all filmed in the same place. From a 3D perspective, one of the difficult things was that in order to physically get the camera inside the car, they had to chop the roof off the car at just above the tops of the windows, and then they created this sort of scaffolding structure which allowed them to position a camera and drop it inside the roof of the vehicle. And then they would have the director, the DOP, and the camera operator all sitting on top of the car, looking through the hole in the roof and directing exactly where the camera would be positioned throughout the course of the shot. So our job was to basically replace the entire roof of the car, as well as a number of other components that we had to add with CG. And the major deal there was the tracking, because, like I say, we had nearly 6,500 frames that we needed to track. It was a completely continuous camera move, and although we had points where we could end our tracking solve, those were very few and far between. And often we needed to track 2,000 frames in a completely continuous camera move in a very small, confined space. And the problem with that was there's very little actual data inside a car to track. Sort of 60 or 70% of the screen space is taken up by the actors. Outside the windows of the car, the background is very motion blurred, so it doesn't track very well. And then the points that we can see in the car don't stay visible for very long, because the actor will move in front of it, move out of the way, and then the camera will move past it. So it was a very tricky shot to track indeed.
And not only that, but that's a very emotionally significant part of the film, so you couldn't afford to be losing it in terms of believability at any point in that. And that was like really quite...
I mean, one of the first things that Alfonso said to us when he came to see us and we met him was that it's very important in all of these shots that the viewer isn't taken out of the viewing experience by noticing the fact that there is computer graphics going on. You know, the computer graphics play an important role, but they're not there necessarily to tell the story. They're there to fill in the gaps, I suppose.
Yeah, there.
We need to make sure that they do remain hidden.
I was going to say that's the thing. Like, I guess I should ask how many shots you actually did, because overall it was not a show that had effects front and center of house. How many shots were there that you guys worked on?
Oh, we worked on, I think, 165 shots by the time we got to the end of the movie.
Wow.
Which doesn't sound a lot, but if you imagine there are only actually 460 shots in the final cut of the film. And I think we actually worked on getting on for 50 minutes worth of actual footage that was in the final cut. So well over half of the movie.
Wow, that's extraordinary. Well, I know that you've got to get back to what you're working on, so thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us.
It's been a pleasure.
And if I can, I'll go over to Andy.
Okay, I'll pass you over now.
Hello.
Hey, Andy, how are you?
Hey, I'm okay, thanks.
We've just been having a really interesting discussion about some of the tracking issues, and from a 2D point of view, I guess, well, firstly, maybe you could tell us your role on the film.
Well, I was the 2D supervisor on the film for Double Negative, and I was also really in charge of compositing the multiple sequence, which was the long car shot, which Dave was just telling you about.
And not only in that shot, but also, I think, in the bus shot, which was... I think the bus shot was green screen, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. that was really one of the only vehicle shots that was shot on a green screen stage, and it actually gave us quite a lot of problems with the amount of noise on the green screen, and just with it being such a large green screen, I think it was quite difficult to light.
What were you shooting on, actually? What was the film shot on?
I think it was shot on Kodak. I can't think what the stock was now. I can get back to you about that.
And so the green screen shots, how'd you go about actually placing the background outside? Because I assumed when I was watching there must have been an effect shot going on there because of the helicopters, but I guess I'd assumed also that it had been a 100% in-camera shot with helicopters added as opposed to the entire environment outside being added.
No, what happened was we had a camera tracking vehicle with lots of cameras mounted on it, giving us almost a 360 degree vista, if you like, of a road that they location they found was a very long straight road. I can't remember the location now, but it was quite remote, and one of the reasons it was shot green screen was that it wasn't practical to take the whole crew out there. So they took this camera tracking vehicle out there and shot all these plates on a gyroscopically stabilized truck. And then we took those plates back and put them into Maya and managed to stabilize them and patch them all together. And then we used that along with the track from the green screen plate of the interior of the bus. And it all came together quite well in the end, and I think it looked quite convincing.
Did you use your, is it Stig tool for that?
In a roundabout kind of a way, it was along the same concept, but actually Stig wouldn't really handle the moving plates, so
right.
We set up a Maya scene, which pretty much was a sort of taking Stig apart and using its theory work to combine them in Maya as a sort of bespoke setup, I suppose.
And what was most of the compositing done on? Was it shake-based?
Yeah, it was entirely shake. That's all the double negative uses for compositing.
And roughly sort of how many people were on the 2D team compositing the shots together?
It's kind of hard to say. It was quite a fluid team because we were working on the show for getting on for a year, I suppose. Right from while they were still shooting, we were starting to comp stuff as plates were being handed over to us. So I suppose at its peak, we probably had maybe 25, 30 compositors at the same time. But that team kind of changed and evolved during the project.
And you were saying that you were personally working on the car sequence that we were hearing about before. I mean, apart from the complexity of tracking, what were some of the other problems you had in that very long sequence?
Just the logistics of trying to set up such a large shot and where to break it up into sections, and because we not only did we replace the roof in that shot, we also were doing some other effects in it, like we added the Molotov cocktail that was thrown at the windscreen, the bike stunt, which was shot for real on the day. They did have a guy on the bike and he fell off and fell into the road, so that wasn't really I don't think it was really considered to be dynamic enough for the action sequence, so we actually did a CG takeover of the bike as it got hit by the car door. So as the bike rolled over the bonnet and sort of bounced across the road, that's all been replaced with a CG bike.
Right, so the one that we actually see in close-up is the CG one? The one we see in close-up on the bonnet of the car during the bit where they, you know, use the car door to defend themselves, that was all CG?
That was, yeah. The takeover point is actually as the character Theo kicks the car door open, we use his hand as it wipes across the window to mix from the real bike to the CG bike. So as the front wheel lifts up and the two riders fall off and the bike comes across the side of the car, that's all entirely CG.
And did you use any image processing tools to get rid of the bike that was there, like a furnace or anything? Do you use stuff like that? Because you had to clean up the plate, of course, to put the CG in.
Yeah, I mean, we had a pretty good paint team on the job. It was pretty much all painted out by hand. A lot of it obviously was covered up by the CG bike, so it meant that we were only really removing the odd wheel and arm here and there. but no, that was all just painted out in Shake using the paint node, really. It was just on the odd frames here and there.
Right. And so obviously the film has a fairly strong look to it overall. What was the considerations for a DI grade? Was it when you were reviewing the shots, how graded were they, or was it still fairly flat?
We were working in the majority of the shots as they came from scan. There was not really any DI grade attached to the plates until quite close to the end of the project. So what we were doing is we were working ungraded, and then on shots where we were doing where we were stitching together the sections, like the multiple sequence and also the Bexhill sequence, which is the end section of the film, which is extremely long, you know, longer even than the multiple sequence. We were actually taking all the plates and doing our own neutral grade to sort of balance them out so that they would work together a single take.
Is the end sequence that
really,
the only
grading that we did, and then the DI was applied after we started delivering shots as final.
The end sequence you're referring to then, is that when they're coming down the stairs and walking out into the road?
It's actually, I think it's a 9-minute long sequence, which starts, I don't know whether you remember, as Theo is exiting a tunnel and he walks out onto a street, and you immediately see a couple of guys getting machine gunned and some jeeps drive by.
Right.
From that point on, the shot's supposed to be a continuous take all the way through to when Theo eventually finds Key and the baby on one of the upper floors of the block of flat. So that, right. That whole sequence was stitched together as one shot.
So there's a lot of pyro going off, like there's gunshots and squibs and stuff going off in that sequence. Was there a lot of stuff added in, or was a lot of the sort of effective gunfire happening on the day?
There's a huge amount of real gunfire going on the day. I mean, it was very well choreographed and set up. I'm amazed that they managed to get it in one take, to be honest. I would say perhaps maybe 30% of the bullet hits and the ground shots that are going off are there on the day and were practical, and then the rest would have been added by us. But then all the larger explosions that were coming from the tanks that were hitting vehicles and things, they were practical on the day as well. And also the initial explosion of the tank firing into the entranceway of the building, that was all done for real.
Yeah, I mean, it was very gritty, and it was seamless. I mean, I was watching it, and I was, when I wasn't on the edge of my seat, I was trying to pay attention to what might be effects, but one just got the general impression that for insurance reasons there had to be some effects in there somewhere, but it was very tightly done.
Yeah, I mean, we were really bulking out bullet hits on the wall and on the ground as well, just to kind of add a bit of pace to it, I suppose, and just make it seem even more chaotic than it already was. And then things like blood hits were also added and beefed up a little bit, where they perhaps weren't showing up as much as you'd have liked them to have been on camera. Some of the headshots and glass breaking as Theo ran through the coaches that people were living in, all that kind of thing. It was really more sort of embellishing on what was already there. It was pretty, I should imagine, for the guys on set, it was about as real as it could get.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
Is it your favourite sequence? I'm just curious, in summing up, you know, was it, because obviously it really is a pretty thought-provoking film, but I'm just wondering from your point of view what your sort of favourite shot or section was.
I mean, it's a technically impressive shot. There are sort of smaller shots in there that I think, if I was going to have to pick a favourite, which It's quite difficult to do. There are shots like the things around the where that we shot around the dog track, and we've added lots of housing blocks and things in the background, and all the billboards on the buses and the big dog track signs. If you can sort of do a comparison between the original plate and what we finished up with, I really like some of those shots. I think we've managed to make a big difference to the feel of the environment, sort of just change the whole look of what was originally shot. I think Alfonso was quite happy with some of the things that we did with that. We tried to keep the whole working process quite fluid on a lot of those shots and sort of suggesting ideas that he might like, and he seemed quite happy for us to do that kind of thing. He didn't go with all of the stuff that we did, but I think it was quite an enjoyable experience trying to think up things, little details that we could add into these scenes.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. And again, I really enjoyed the film. And apart from an uneasy walk back to my hotel in the heart of London, it was great.
Okay, that's it's nice of you to say that.
And we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks, David, for taking the time to speak with us. Again, kudos to the team at Double Negative, who did an outstanding job in creating this bleak and dreary London. It really helped tell the story in the film. In part two of our podcast, Mike and I were fortunate enough to be able to drop by the studios of Framestore CFC when we were in London in the heart of Soho. And there we met up with Tim Weber, who is the VFX supervisor for the film. And we asked him what their greatest challenge was in creating visual effects for Children of Men.
We did quite a few baby shots and a few other shots, but you know, by far the largest challenge and the amount of work we did really was on the one shot that was the birth sequence. You know.
So for those people that may not have seen the film, this is both incredibly plot significant, but also quite a confronting scene in that that this is not done off camera.
Absolutely, yeah. It's as on camera as could possibly got away with legally.
Yeah, and it's tastefully done, obviously.
Yeah.
But as you're right, it's quite explicit. Tell me, how did you go about doing that? Was the solution? I got to say right off the bat, I think it was seamless. Like it was just so good.
Thank you.
And so I just started worrying about the hygienic nature of the set, and I started worrying about how you could get a real baby there, and obviously it wasn't a real baby at some point, and. So what was the approach, and at what point did you realise it was going to be that that well seen? And what was it obvious from the script stage that you'd have to solve it that hard, or did it become apparent that it was going to be that big a shot?
From the word go, the director came in and said to us, I want a single continuous take where the woman walks into the room and sits down on the mattress and gives birth, and then we have a minute's worth of the baby afterwards. So from the word go, we knew it was incredibly complicated.
Did you ever think about doing a prosthetic baby?
We never thought about doing it completely prosthetic. Right. There was discussion as to how much, you know, prosthetic and how much CG to use, and you know whether certain it should be prosthetic, and then we should do a takeover to CG after a certain point. I mean, the idea of doing it prosthetic, you could get a prosthetic baby to look excellent. There's no doubt about that, but you could never get it to move, you know, in a realistic way.
Yeah, and faces are always a giveaway. Yeah,
and certainly to get one that would move realistically, that you didn't have huge control lines going to, you know, I mean, even to get it to move semi-realistically without huge control lines. And because of the giving birth aspect of it, that was impossible. So it became clear quite, you know, it was clear immediately that it couldn't be completely prosthetic. And it became clear quite soon that the best way was to do it pretty much all CG. You know, there was a prosthetic object there
for the actors to
hold. Yeah, but it was totally replaced.
I mean, the whole film would be let down if that looked fake. I mean, that is just such a big point in the film.
Absolutely, it's the key plot moment probably of the whole film, yeah.
And everything that follows was because of it, and everything that was happened before it built to it. So no pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it a matter of Were there any approaches that you deployed to try and increase that realism? Were you fastidious in taking HDR readings, or was there anything that...
We did take HDR images, you know, for the lighting reference, but I don't think there was anything other than lots of hard work, really. You know, we used a few techniques that we hadn't used before, nothing that was majorly rocket science, but we just, you know, paid a lot of attention to it. And
so I assume you must have had some kind of visual reference from real births for the animators.
We had quite a lot of visual reference from real births, and it was quite tough looking at them to begin with. You got used to it after a while, even to the point of you would be scrolling forwards and backwards through it, watching babies come out and go back in and come out and go back in. And it was a bit strange, but yeah, we did look at a lot of reference.
So for that to work, obviously the 3D needs to look real, and did you deploy subsurface scattering for the skin?
Absolutely, yeah, you know, that was part of what we used.
And then you have to have the actors interact. I mean, you can't be at arm's length with a baby, and in that shot in particular, you can't be at arm's length because, you know, it's not like the baby was bound. It was, yeah, eventually, of course.
Yeah.
So what were the actors... Was it hard to track that? Was that...
Tracking was very hard, very hard. It was a very dark room. It was handheld light, which made a lot of things hard. I mean, it wasn't handheld light for all the time, but it was a handheld camera, handheld light for a lot of the time, very dark. You know, it was the only light in the room was this handheld light, so it's dark shadows. They were holding, you know, this object that was a baby in all sorts of ways, so tracking was really tough, yeah. Probably, you know, one of the hardest aspects of it was getting
right, I think your team might have used 3D equalizer on that, if I'm not mistaken. It was...
Yes, I think we did a bit. It was mostly... Buju we used, right. I think. But
okay. Did you have any issues with therefore the blending? Was there any like work done either on eye lines or hand movements, or was the stand in enough to get that nailed?
No, we had to manipulate the hands and manipulate, you know, bits of the mother's body when the baby was laid down on her. There was a bit of manipulating the filmed elements to fit the baby because although Theo is, you know, he's holding the baby, he's holding a stationary prosthetic, and as soon as we put an animated baby there, what he's doing with his hands isn't right, so we did have to manipulate that a fair amount to make that work.
So just finally, how long would a sequence like that take? I mean, not on set, but in your pipeline, was it something that was in the pipeline for weeks, months, days?
It was quite close to 9 months, actually, from the very beginning. I mean, it started, as babies do, it started incredibly small with someone doing some tests to see if we could get a baby to look realistic and us sort of planning stuff out, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't really full on for quite a while. But, yeah, from the very word go to the end, it was getting close to 9 months.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about it, because it really was outstanding.
Okay, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like to take a moment to thank the folks at Framestore CFC who let us take over their conference room for the afternoon and conduct several podcast interviews. One of those podcasts is actually going to be over at our sister site, FXPHD, and that's with Christina Boom, who's the lead of 3D tracking there at Framestore CFC. It's actually a nice tie-in with our term curriculum over at that site, where we're somewhat focusing on 3D tracking, object tracking, and all the technology related to that. That's, of course, in addition to our regular term curriculum with courses in After Effects, Final Cut Pro, Combustion, Shake, Toxic, Luster, Maya, Photoshop, and Furnace, as well as a course on digital color theory. Over on Effects Guide, in the coming weeks, we'll also have a podcast interview with the folks in the DI department from Framestore CFC as well, so be on the lookout for that. Well, that's it for this week and this week's FX podcast. For Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.